So I wanted to start by discussing the kind of research crisis I had that delayed the episode. Originally, this was going to be a B-side mini-episode about Space Museum, a very important British synth-punk tape. I wanted to discuss the history because they were a one-hit wonder album, like a very important album, but they're not really known for anything else. But the first article I found on them was by another music writer detailing their inability to find any information about Solid Space or Space Museum. That seemed like a good indication that I wouldn't be able to go any further with that. When looking at the troubles I had this time, the best thing I can compare it to are the two episodes that I felt I did well on, which were Henry Rollins and Japan Noise. I think these two went the best because for Henry Rollins, I already knew a lot of that stuff, so I knew where to look, and for Japan Noise, it's well documented, but not necessarily familiar to the average person.
Mm-hmm.
So it was
that was a fun one too, Japan
yeah.
Noise.
Well,
so I was
yeah,
that average person.
Good material as well.
Yeah.
What I ended up doing this time was No Wave New York and the four bands that were featured on the Brian Eno No Wave album. This seemed at first like it wasn't going to go well. I didn't know it that well, and the material might not be there once I started researching it. So I waited a pretty long time to actually, like, go into it, as opposed to all the other stuff. But I kind of learned a lesson that I have to keep learning, which is, if you just do the research, the material kind of comes on its own. Because once I finally got into reading it from the band leader of the first group, James Chance, I found a really moving section he had in an interview. This is the interviewer talking. Your music, you have to admit, has a very confrontational manner. You grapple with it. You grapple with it. James Chance. That's the reason I used to physically attack people in my audience.
He grapples with them.
Praise the Lord.
Praise the Lord.
I'm back on my bullshit. This is No Wave New York. So I'll just start by asking you what you thought about the first group. You understand how the album was laid out?
Yeah. The first group, I think it was a good starter group.
Yeah, that was James Chance and the Contortions.
I think it was a good starter group. It does a really good job of like familiarizing yourself with what you're getting yourself into. I think they had a pretty good variety to their songs because they had four tracks, right? Was it four?
Yes, each group got four tracks.
Yeah, so I think like the journey that they kind of like took the listener through, like did work out. I don't want to say they were not one of my favorite ones because that sounds a little mean, but I did like some of the other ones more.
Okay.
They were a good like intro group, I think.
I think I'm a bit biased because I was already familiar with the various James Chance projects.
Oh no, there's more than one.
Yeah, he had a very famous album called Bye, which you might recognize the cover of. That had some of the same songs on it, but that's kind of seen as the definitive release of his. He lasted a lot longer than the other people on this album because he didn't have a group, so to speak. A lot of the other bands in this scene, especially these four bands, just kind of lost and gained members at a very constant rate.
I know that that's pretty, like, common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So James Chance's mentality was he was just going to have, like, a backup band, and he would just find people who he knew could play the music. And that allowed him to both kind of grow
as an... It's good for the brand, yeah.
Yeah, it let him have a lot of control of the music and his, like, character, his stage character, and also kind of expand the actual quality of his music, because he's surprisingly classist for a... well, not maybe not classist, but he has a lot of expectations for a punk musician.
Okay. I think I might like him by the sound of what I'm hearing.
He came out of Wisconsin and was actually a jazz fan, and I think he played jazz piano for a very long time.
Yeah, I could definitely hear that, like, I think, in his, yeah.
He ended up taking the sax as well when he was an adult, and that became the thing he was known for playing. With his mindset, because he's asked about it, a lot of the people, this was like a community, and a lot of the people in the other bands had never been musicians before. And his mindset was, that can work if you just kind of do it and actually work to develop the quality and sound, if you kind of grow into it.
Mm-hmm.
Like he feels he did, and he feels that the leader of Teenage Jesus did. The bassist on Public Image Limited was also like a first-time musician.
The bassist of the Sex Pistols was a...
Well, yeah, and...
Yeah.
Both of those were Johnny Rotten projects. But he's also very kind of, like, dismissive when he feels like people don't live up to what they should be able to do as a musician. In one of his interviews, he talks about a conversation he had with another musician over hip-hop.
Oh, no.
And the guy he's talking to that he relays the point of is basically, yeah, some of their stuff sounds kind of like ours, but they don't get why. Like, they're occasionally good, but only by accident.
Oh, boy.
Which, yeah. It's also probably worth noting that his second most famous project was... He changed his name to James White, and the group was James White and the Blacks.
I like... Oh, man.
Another interesting quality with his dynamic of having basically just, like, paid, like, band players is that a lot of the groups kind of left New York and just became comfortable somewhere else. A lot of, like, I think one group was just in Spain, and they just kind of got used to living in Barcelona. They liked it, so they just stayed there. Whereas James Chance, he'll go to a place like France and just form a new band.
Yeah, I can see how that's, like, a pretty, like, DIY thing, like, grassrootsy.
He couldn't be bothered to, like, fly anyone else out. Interestingly, though, he actually approves of disco, in theory. He said he didn't like many disco tracks that he listened to, but he enjoys the trance-like groove. And he actually approved of a disco remix of one of his songs. He was asked by the label back when everything had to be disco, and he was a musician in the late 70s. That's when No New York was recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And he felt that when he was asked to make his version of disco with no extra instructions, he just got a guy to, like, do a new version of Contort Yourself.
Okay. Right. Was that one of the ones on No New York?
It may have been. That ends up on a lot of his.
I would love to hear the disco version of that. I couldn't imagine. It sounds like a challenge. Make this disco-y.
Yeah, he tried to do it a couple times before, but he found that he plays he plays too quickly. It wasn't on the first on that okay. one, but it was on By. He found that he plays too fast for a disco track. Yeah,
I absolutely believe that.
I think, and I believe I wrote this as my sort of immediate response to his section, that he's a good example of the punk mindset. He's very memorable and energetic, even though it's kind of limited in terms of talent, at least at that point in his career. And he focuses more on just layering the lines that he does have and that he can do. And he's one of the more interesting people in interviews of really any musician I've read. Goddamn.
That, again, I absolutely don't doubt for a second.
Yeah, I just found a bunch of weird statements from various interviews of his.
So how did he get his start exactly? Like, do I want to know?
Well, he was he just wanted to be a musician, and he liked jazz, and he liked punk, and he generally liked funk as well. So he just kind of did all of them.
Okay.
In fact, he was, according to him, the only musician in Manhattan who played both major punk and major jazz clubs.
Okay, I see. So I can definitely see that in like the whole, and like what we were listening to there.
Yeah, so he was like a CBGB guy and a jazz club guy. Which probably brings us to what happened when he performed in Soho. You see, that was at an art performance space, and his stage performance, he kind of prides himself on being a very active, energetic presence on the stage. He wants his, like, dancing to be a part of the show as much as the music.
Grappling his audience.
Well, yeah, he wants the audience to join in. And at this performance art space, everyone watching just kind of sat on the floor and just stared at him. So he leaves the stage and starts trying to force them to their feet to at least get them to stand up. This results in an altercation and a very publicized fight that he's asked about to this day. And in fact, he got a reputation for it after that happened. And so people would show up to his shows just to fight him.
Oh no, it's Henry Rollins.
Though, in his words, that solved the problem I had. Because
it's a feature, not a bug.
He wanted them to be energetic, and now they were showing up to attack him. And this did cause several problems for him, since that's what he became known for amongst a lot of like industry people. They just saw him as the violence guy. And two, some of those encounters were apparently kind of dangerous. He actually get hurt a few times.
I mean, like anything, there's like alcohol involved. It's just more, you know, more sus.
There's a lot, I guess, I include everything I read from in the show notes, but it would be weird to read nothing of his, since I have a lot of it in front of me. Quote, originally I had this girl. She was the girlfriend of Alan Vega, and something. She had this homemade synthesizer that had like 2 octaves. After she kind of dropped out, I had this little punkette girl, Debbie, who worked at this punk clothing store on St. Mark's. They called her Debbie Revenge. Had her singing 1 or 2 rehearsals. She wasn't really serious, so after that I decided, enough of this. I was just going to sing the songs and let the chips fall where they may. Because it was true. Like, Richard Hell didn't have anyone's idea of what a trained voice would sound like. But all kinds of other people were doing the same thing. Nobody cared if you had any kind of training or voice, or even if you could carry a tune, as long as you could project yourself somehow.
I think, honestly, I don't disagree with, like, much of what he says, like, even about the whole, like, holding your musicians to, like, a high standard.
Mm-hmm.
Is, So I know, like, obviously from, like, fighting his audience and stuff, like, what's, like, kind of, like, what's his place in the whole No Wave scene? You know, is he a good guy or, like, a bad guy or...
I mean, for that scene, like, they're fine with him.
Okay.
He's the one that kind of lasted. He has a lot more mainstream respect than a lot of the others. I think he's more famous. With the exception of Brian Eno, who recorded the album. Though, in James Chance's words, it was more like a field recording. He claims that Brian Eno didn't really produce it. He just kind of recorded them playing. We should move on to Teenage Jesus and the Jerks.
Yay.
Okay, well, I just put in a pause so I could edit in their song. They had the shortest song on the album at 16 seconds. I'm sorry, 34 seconds. 16 would just be absurd. My immediate response to their section was probably... I think one of the more obvious frontrunners of indie rock over the next, like, two decades. I think the way she sounds carried over more than the other bands, except maybe DNA.
Yeah, I remember when I was listening to it, the first thing that's, like, stuck out to me was the cool sounds. Like, they did, like, introduce, like, a ton of, like, different sounds. That's kind of, like, what... differentiated from DNA for me. Like every song there's like some new like component or element that kind of just like got my attention.
And I do think
her voice was a really good, like, did a lot for it.
It was darker than I expected, but I actually think they might have they might have won the Ripping Yourself Off award.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an award on every, like, punk album with more than one band.
Ripping yourself off. I kind of like that. That's how you evolve.
Yeah, every punk band is just like, okay, so for this song, let's do the same arrangement, but with one more chord.
Yeah, it's like the only musicians that they're learning from are themselves.
Interesting fact about them is that apparently Steve Albini once cited Flip Your Face as his favorite song.
Oh, wow. Again, I also don't find that difficult to believe at all.
Yeah, Steve Albini is a weird guy. Though he was into that music back when it was hard to find. That was another thing about this album that's kind of interesting. One of the reviews I found explicitly stated that you probably couldn't get your hands on the record, and this was written back when it was released, because you had to, like, special order the tape or something. Yeah. It was apparently hard to get a copy, and according to the Mars Band, they said that a lot of the music and shows only exist because some guy was recording them.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah. And I'm sure at first all of the, like, club owners hated him, but now that's, like, the last vestige of their legacy. Yeah. Some guy they probably tried to, like, kick out.
Literally bootlegging.
Yeah. So front woman of Teenage Jesus is Lydia Lunch. Lydia Lunch. She's from Rochester, New York, and she founded the band when she was 16.
Damn, good for her.
Two of the original members would not end up being on the No Wave New York album, even though the band was formed 2 years before that album was recorded. One of them was James Chance, saxophonist. He ended up leaving the band because Lydia did not want a sax on her. She felt like it was out of place.
Yeah. It's a tough call to make, so I kind of respect that.
There was also a Japanese bassist, Rek, who had to go back to Japan.
Damn.
Yeah, that's another feature of this scene. There were a lot of Japanese musicians.
Really? Does that have anything to do, I'm guessing, with like the Japanese, like, noise?
I don't think Japan noise was a thing yet. There was a punk scene. I think it has more to do with the fact that it was 1979 and that Toyota money was really starting to come in. There was a huge class of, like, Japanese art kids.
What about this goth thing? Would you not say, Exene, that Lydia... I don't know, when I think your name, Lydia Lynch, aside from Lena Lovitch, I kind of think a bit of goth. And I think the Cramps got goth, too. I think a lot of New York bands got a goth following. What is goth? And have any goths been coming out to this Rude Hieroglyphics tour?
I don't know. I don't care.
Look, Nardo, goth has nothing to do with me. It's like saying, you know, everyone with black hair looks like Susie and the Banshees. I mean, you got to get with it, dude. You know, your categorizing is just making no sense to me.
You know, like this people coming out to gigs and you go, oh, look, there's the goths, you know?
Who gives a shit what they look like? It's what they think about that's important.
And then the people who did end up being on the record were a trio with drummer Bradley Field and bassist / percussionist Jim Sklavounos.
Hey, it's me. I managed to fuck that previous part up. The members of Teenage Jesus and the Jerks were Lydia Lunch, guitar vocals, Gordon Stevenson, bass, and Bradley Field, drums. Sorry about the confusion.
But the most notable thing about Teenage Jesus was by the point they recorded this album, 18-year-old front woman, who I don't think was a musician when she formed the band.
I see.
To quote something that I'm stealing this from, Teenage Jesus and the Jerks were the center of New York's short-lived no-wave movement. Played 10 to 15 minute shows, never released a full length album, and disbanded after a relatively brief existence.
Oh, that sounds sick.
1979, when the band issued a couple of EPs on the Lust Unlust label, new bassist joined the group. However, they disbanded by the end of the year. Lydia moved on to other projects. She's no James Chance, but she is quite good in interviews. What has been your most energizing interaction with the crowd at one of these shows? Lydia Lunch, when they started singing along with the lyrics, I just started changing them. I don't even remember the fucking lyrics. Stop it. Whatever. It's just hilarious, and it's hilarious that it riles me up.
So confrontational. It's always like with these like no wave musicians, like it can't be easy. Yeah. Doesn't want to be a walk in the park.
Yeah. I mean, what would you expect from like the avant-garde version of punk?
Nothing less, honestly.
Yeah, it's just the two like worst kinds of uncompromising and musician.
Imagine about what women like most in men. What do you like?
If they're underage, I like it.
Exene?
So they're probably not any in her.
Jeez, I don't really like anything about men in general.
No?
No. That's why I'm married.
Well, your husband probably appreciates that.
No,
well,
I love my husband.
That's a bit different.
But I would never consider him to be just a man, you know? Like, men as things.
You guys must run into groupies. Especially
no.
Touring.
How about you? Huh? You must run into a few in your day and age, too.
Oh, yeah.
I bet. TV, hey,
oh,
there's a
time.
heavy.
So there was one huge issue with me trying to research this movement. And that's because the book that is used for, like, kind of an academic understanding of the history and very brief scene of the New York avant-garde punk no wave movement is called Rip It Up and Start Again. The used copy of this book, $95.
Jesus Christ.
And
why?
It's a photo book. The moment photography is involved, those prices skyrocket.
Oh boy. Like I say. Yeah, so it's not like it's just like a book. You can, like, pirate it, put it online.
I was able to get some of it. But not enough of it. One thing I did catch was that Rip It Up and Start Again opens with a quote where Elvis Costello says, writing about music is like dancing about architecture, which I think is stupid. Writing about music is something we've been doing for centuries.
And it's just the discussion. Yeah,
depending on
discussing
your,
music.
Yeah, like, that's a very historic thing we've been doing for a long time. The fact that they're two different activities doesn't make it even the slightest bit odd or impossible.
Generally, like, if you make something and people write about it, that's kind of, like, good.
Also, considering what you count as architecture, we've also been dancing around it for a very long time. Things like the Maypole churches. I much prefer the David Lee Roth quote, which is, music critics like Elvis Costello because music critics look like Elvis Costello. Which is actually true.
Oh my god, there's no lie.
David Lee Roth coming out with the truest statement in,
damn,
the history of punk. What,
he went hard.
And I think he said that to a person. Like
to their face.
How did that person not just, like, go drown themselves in a bathtub after that? Just walk home and immediately face plant into the first, like,
it's just
toilet bowl of water.
That should have been the last quote ever. So, I mean, it's honestly still true.
Yeah, no, it's completely, it's significantly more true now.
Yeah.
So Mars. Mars is the third band on the album.
Mars is sick.
I was really surprised by how much I like Mars, because, one, I had not heard of them before this. They're probably the least famous group on here. And two...
What's their story? Oh, sorry.
Well, I was going to say, two, they gave me the most comprehensive history I was able to find on the subject.
Wow. That is very abnormal. It's very atypical.
Just coming out of the gates with basically everything. About all of the groups, too. So what I said, Mose... I actually thought Mose was DNA at first. DNA was kind of disappointing. One of the more spose styles of the kind of avant-garde punk music, playing heavily into the silence of the stage and, in this case, recording... I don't think they do it badly, but it's very hard to do that well enough to not kind of get overshadowed by the other people who do it better.
It's really hit or miss.
It's very hard, to not just kind of sound like a worse version of Red Crayola. Is that like a thing people know? Chat, do I have to explain that?
Chat, Red Crayola. I was just like, yep, Red Crayola.
Red Crayola of Coconut Hotel.
I do not know of Coconut Hotel.
Parable of Arable Land.
I'm not punk.
Neither.
I'm not fucking punk.
All right. Red Crayola episode.
Write that one down. Note to self.
But yeah, I thought they were very underrated, especially with the reviews of the album that I read. A lot of them didn't give Mars much attention, but I thought they were good.
That was like another Cool Sounds one. That's what I noticed.
Yeah.
I think more so than the last one for some reason. They introduced the cool sounds, but this one, like, just used them to cool effect.
Yeah, I think this one, like I said, used silence a lot more, so the sounds stood out.
It's a bit more like hectic at points. It's a really, like, you don't hear that a lot in music. It's just silence.
Mm-hmm. Especially not on something like this. I mean, compare this to the James Chance section.
Mm-hmm.
Endless
cacophonous.
Yeah, like punk sax. the interesting thing about Mars is that they actually had one person that they referred to as a child prodigy. Apparently their piano player Sumner. Do I have a full name here? Well, apparently their piano player Sumner was like a really good piano player as a kid.
That's a really weird one for punk, honestly.
Yeah.
Like sax is weird.
I think sax is probably weirder than piano, because piano you can tone into like a synthesizer.
Yeah.
Which is fairly punk.
Like transfer over, yeah.
But I think it's weird that even in this band, there were a lot of just non-musicians until, of course, they become a member. But then they just have one guy who is a great, like, child pianist.
Every one of our sentences are just beginning, I think it's weird.
Yeah.
Because this whole thing is weird.
They also founded a bit earlier than groups like Teenage Jesus, 75, which... like 3 years and their time is a lifetime for these bands.
75, that's a pretty crazy... because I know the Ramones were getting to get active in like 70... their first record, I think, was 73 or 4, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's generally like regarded as like the genesis of like American punk. So that's like... boy, that's a weird time, 75. When was Sonic Youth? When did they take off? Well, I think they might have been like contemporaries, because I know like Talking Heads were kind of like late 70s, so... I'm just getting like my timeline straight. I need to visualize things to make sense of all this.
I think these guys were a bit earlier than Sonic Youth was 81.
Okay, yeah.
I think Mokey Moon, which I think was like 77, is talked about a lot in these interviews.
Yeah, so
I think that's kind of the fulcrum.
Mm-hmm.
Of the new wave stuff. These interviews, this guy just drops like every show he could find them in, which led to the phrase, "Wow, Weasel, I'm impressed." this also is the interview that mentions that there was a guy named Dan Graham who used to tape a lot of concerts, and
Oh, I see.
He was, yeah. Oh, Moe's had an issue because the original band name was China.
That is an issue.
This was, but they had to change it because there was a pop group who were getting like a real push from studios calling themselves China.
Yeah, you're gonna lose that fight every time.
Yeah, so one of them had a dream, and in the dream they saw a theater where the marquee said Patti Smith and Moe's.
Oh.
So they decided to change their band name to Moe's, and they did eventually, actually, that did actually come true. They did play with Patti Smith.
Oh my god. The fucking prophecy.
Yeah. They played with a lot of good people. They mention the Feelies. They mention Richard Hell, Suicide. A lot of the important new wavers. But I'd recommend just reading this in general, because they have a lot of interesting... Their history is much more comprehensive in this. In 74 and 75, it was really just a local underground scene, but as the Talking Heads and Patti Smith, the Ramones, and television released albums, it started to get a lot more popular, and the bands lost some of their original energy going for whatever formula they felt they had. So at this point, we all started thinking we could give this a new blast that the scene needed. Then on one hand, you had the burgeoning punk scene, which included a lot of boring rock bands, and on the other, a bunch of new, very amateur groups looking for any sound that was different and cool. Moe's started really in December 75, but we spent a year playing in a loft before we went public as China. Which is a weird sentence. Sometimes in 77, we started sharing a rehearsal space with Teenage Jesus, The Cramps, and later DNA and The Contortions. There was a lot of mixing and jamming and feelings in common, but we never decided to be a movement.
I've never heard of like people speak like that. I've never heard that utterance, we never decided to be a movement.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like, I guess that is like a decision like you can make.
Yeah, I guess they didn't want to... That kind of happened for them. And I don't think you can decide that, but...
Yeah. So it's just weird. It's weird to think on.
But they really thought they were going to kind of square the circle. They thought they had... No New Wave had been a very big thing relative to... come out at the right time. They had a second win. They had a really big show, and then they just did not have big shows again. And by that point, like, the places they could rely on started closing, and the other places they could rely on started being more and more punk, like capital P traditional punk. And a group like Moe's just kind of got lost in the shuffle. And then it did what a lot of these groups do. It just kind of, like, changed. They moved around a couple of different members.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was kind of an unfortunate ending there, considering it seemed like they could have gotten a lot bigger than they did. At least to them at the time.
Yeah. It's kind of like, just like, it's like the weird thing about the whole punk movement. It's definitely like an ecology. It's like a lot of it is out of your hands.
Mm-hmm.
Like we're talking about like deciding to not be a movement.
Yeah. And it kind of sucks, especially after watching that like metal documentary.
I forgot about that one. Yeah.
Like all the signs, according to this interview, really looked like they were going to kind of break through. And then not only did that path close, but the stuff they were able to rely on closed behind them.
The world's changing, yeah. That's always going to be the punk trademark or music.
Yeah. It's also interesting that punk always kind of positions itself as the insurgent, but in this case, they kind of became, as far as this movement is concerned, what all of the clubs were demanding and all the establishment, like, gatekeepers were demanding.
Has always been another, like, trademark of the whole, I don't know, like, the whole, you know what I mean, community.
Mm-hmm.
The underground. You just can't be hardcore enough for some people.
Nope. Another interesting thing, a lot of the groups have okay opinions about New York.
Interesting.
Lydia Lunch, for instance, is scared by living in America. She finds it to be a pretty threatening place, which is why she is kind of happy in Europe. But she made a distinction that Los Angeles was, in fact, more dangerous than New York from her point of view. I think James Chance also said he was pretty happy in New York. The group, the members of Mars, who were, I think, had the highest, I think they had the most women in their group, they were kind of bothered by some of the experience of living in New York. And this is like the 70s, like late 70s New York.
Yeah, it's pretty understandable. Yeah.
Kind of the worst period it probably ever had, in terms of safety.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people, that was kind of exciting, and I think it was also kind of exciting for them, but it was also pretty rough a lot of the time.
In a different way.
Yeah. Quote,
sometimes exciting is not always good.
A constant adventure, as well as danger. I lost count of the muggings I went through, although we all knew how to react and come out unscathed and more or less unaffected. It was a question of keeping you cool and handing over immediately any money you might have on you.
Jesus.
It was also a good idea to know which streets not to walk down at night, although you were almost always likely to get mugged in broad, almost as likely to get mugged in broad daylight on busy streets. I wore men's clothing to be less of a target.
Oh, Christ. That's another, yeah.
All right, DNA. DNA, probably the best, but I think from like a kind of like third position objective standpoint or like a talent standpoint, but I kind of disliked it the most because of that. It didn't have the energy of Chance's group. It didn't have the sound of Moses. I think it got kind of caught between two good versions of something instead of one great version of it.
Yeah. I kind of felt the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to end it off, you know what I mean? Like, is definitely one of the tamer ones. By the time you get there, you're, like, kind of exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I still, like, enjoyed their music, you know? But, it really, like, let you off easy at the end.
I kind of felt like if they had like the structure other bands get, they might have been able to really grow on this. I think they had a lot of like a good base for really developing like actual talent and musical I guess quality. But I mean, it's like every other group, they just had a lot of band changes originally.
I'm saying that starts to seep its way into your sound. You know, there's like the consistency of the players aren't really carrying over. It's It's not necessarily a bad thing, you know, but...
And the goofs are usually pretty short-lived. A pretty interesting thing, they had obviously a lot of members. The original lineup was Otto Lindsay, Robin Crutchfield, and Ikue Mori. They made a lot of their recordings in, like, 78. And I think the No New York recording was 79, so...
Mm-hmm.
They were probably one of the faster growers. But... They rarely played outside of New York. They never recorded again. They broke up in 82. Lindsay formed a different group. Lindsay was Brazilian, and the new group was actually meant to be like a kind of Brazilian act.
Oh, that's cool. That's another thing I've never heard of.
He went on to produce records for Brazilian superstar Caetano Veloso. Ikue Mori is still performing avant-garde music in New York City, so I actually think she came back and apparently had one of the better experiences there. I think she said she was fairly comfortable there, or at least that's where the stuff is. In 2008, she celebrated her 30th year in the city.
Ooh, 30.
And what?
No, just geez.
John Zorn's great Japanese import label Avant was able to release a previously unavailable live recording of DNA. And I think one of the more interesting things were their connections to other bands. Crutchfield pretty quickly moved to a group called Dark Day, but they replaced him with bassist Tim Wright of the very, very important post-punk band Per Ubu of Cleveland.
How do you spell that?
P-E-R-E-U-B-U.
Okay, Per Ubu.
Probably pronouncing it wrong. I can't remember if Tim Wright was the one who got into an argument with Henry Rollins over politics recently.
Okay, I was going to say, like, dude, arguing with Henry Rollins about politics.
Because I remember finding that in the research I did, but I don't know if I brought it up.
Yes, yeah. It can't be super easy with him ever.
So, I guess just like on the album, DNA kind of closes us out on a pretty low note. Wasn't really all that much to say about them. After starting with James Chance attacking people. So, any final thoughts on No Wave?
I liked it a lot. I definitely wish I had an opportunity to get way more into it when I was, like, in high school, because I could definitely see myself kind of, like, scratching that itch really hard, because I was one of the biggest, like, Ramones fans ever when I was there, and then I got, like, also really into Sonic Youth, so... That compilation really did it for me. So I was, like, pretty glad to kind of get into it. James Chance, I think, is my guy.
He's coming
away from this.
He was a very interesting person to read. And I do like the kinds of music he combines.
Yeah, absolutely. He reminded me, like, a little bit of, like, when it comes to the... I don't want to say demanding excellence, but it's kind of like Frank Zappa-ish, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's very him thing, and then, like, you get, like, the saxophone, so... I thought it was really cool. I think we had an interesting month.
Yeah, it turned out better than I thought it would.